urban setting. I get extremely bored in nature and prefer walking around the Jewish quarter of Venice to spending time in Bora Bora. Footnote. The argument often heard about primitive people living, on average, less than 30 years ignores the distribution around that average. Life expectancy needs to be analyzed conditionally. Plenty died early from injuries. Many lived very long and healthy lives. This is exactly the elementary fooled by randomness mistake, relying on the notion of average in the presence of variance that makes people underestimate risks in the stock market. By the same argument, we can lower 90% of black swan risks in economic life by just eliminating speculative debt. The only thing currently missing from my life is panic from, say, finding a gigantic snake in my library or watching the economist Myron Scholes, armed to the teeth, walk into my bedroom in the middle of the night. I lack what the biologist Robert Sapolsky calls the beneficial aspect of acute stress, compared to the deleterious one of dull stress, another barbell. For no stress plus a little bit of extreme stress is vastly better than a little bit of stress, like mortgage worries, all the time. Some have argued that my health benefits come from long walks, about 10 to 15 hours a week, though nobody has explained to me why they would count as workouts since I walk slowly, while others claim that they come from my few minutes of sprinting. I've had the same problem explaining the inseparability of the two extremes as I did explaining economic deviations. If you have acute stressors, then periods of rest, how can you separate the stressors from the recovery? Extremistan is characterized by both polar extremes, a high share of low impact, a low share of high impact. Consider that the presence of concentration, here energy expenditure, necessitates that a high number of observations do not contribute to anything except to the dilution. Just as the condition that makes market volatility explained by bursts, say one day in 5 years represents half the variance, requires that most other days remain exceedingly quiet. If one in a million authors makes half the sales, you need a lot of authors to sell no books. This is the turkey trap I will discuss later. Philistines and Federal Reserve chairpersons mistake periods of low volatility caused by stabilization policies for periods of low risk, not for switches into extremistan. Welcome to gray extremistan. Do not tamper too much with the complex system Mother Nature gave you, your body. Beware manufactured stability. By a variant of the same reasoning, we can see how the fear of volatility I mentioned earlier, leading to interference with nature so as to impose regularity, makes us more fragile across so many domains. Preventing small forest fires sets the stage for more extreme ones. Giving out antibiotics when it is not very necessary makes us more vulnerable to severe epidemics, and perhaps to that big one, the grand infection that will be resistant to known antibiotics and will travel on Air France. Which brings me to another organism, economic life. Our aversion to variability and desire for order, and our acting on those feelings have helped precipitate severe crises. Making something artificially bigger instead of letting it die early if it cannot survive stressors makes it more and more vulnerable to a very severe collapse, as I showed with the black swan vulnerability associated with an increase in size. Another thing we saw in the 2008 debacle, the U.S. government, or rather the Federal Reserve, had been trying for years to iron out the business cycle, leaving us exposed to a severe disintegration. This is my argument against stabilization policies and the manufacturing of a non-volatile environment. More on that later. Next, I will discuss a few things about the black swan idea that do not appear to easily penetrate consciousness. Predictably. 3. Margaritas ante porcos. Footnote. In Latin, pearls before swine. How not to sell books in airports. Mineral water in the desert. How to denigrate other people's ideas and succeed at it. Let me start again. The black swan is about consequential epistemic limitations, both psychological, hubris and biases, and philosophical, mathematical, limits to knowledge, both individual and collective. I say consequential because the focus is on impactful rare events, as our knowledge, both empirical and theoretical, breaks down with those. The more remote the events, the less we can forecast them. Yet they are the most impactful. So the Black Swan is about human error in some domains, swelled by a long tradition of scientism and a plethora of information that fuels confidence without increasing knowledge. It covers the expert problem, harm caused by reliance on scientific-looking charlatans, with or without equations, or regular non-charlatanic scientists with a bit more confidence about their methods than the evidence warrants. The focus is in not being the turkey in places where it matters, though there is nothing wrong in being a fool where that has no effect. Main errors in understanding the message. I will briefly state some of the difficulties in understanding the message and the ideas of this book, typically perpetrated by professionals, though surprisingly less by the casual reader, the amateur, my friend. Here is a list. 1. Mistaking the Black Swan, capitalized, for the logical problem. Mistake made by UK intellectuals. Intellectuals in other countries do not know enough analytical philosophy to make that mistake. Footnote. Most intellectuals keep attributing the Black Swan expression to Popper or Mill, sometimes Hume, in spite of the quote by Juvenal. The Latin expression niger cygnus might even be more ancient, possibly of Etruscan origin. 2. Saying the maps we had were better than having no maps. People who do not have experience in cartography risk experts, or worse, employees of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. This is the strangest of errors. I know few people who would board a plane heading for LaGuardia Airport in New York City with a pilot who was using a map of Atlanta's airport, because there is nothing else. People with a functioning brain would rather drive, take the train, or stay home. Yet once they get involved in economics, they all prefer professionally to use in extremistan the measures made for mediocristan, on the ground that we have nothing else. The idea, well accepted by grandmothers, that one should pick a destination for which one has a good map, not travel and then find the best map, is foreign to PhDs in social science. 3. Thinking that a black swan should be a black swan to all observers. Mistake made by people who have not spent a lot of time in Brooklyn and lack the street smarts and social intelligence to realize that some people are suckers. 4. Not understanding the value of negative advice, don't do, and writing to me to ask me for something constructive or a next step. Mistake usually made by chairmen of large companies and those who would like someday to become such chairman. Footnote. One frequent confusion. People believe that I am suggesting that agents should bet on black swans taking place, when I am saying that they should avoid blowing up should a black swan take place. As we will see in Section 4, I am advocating omission, not commission. The difference is enormous, and I have been completely swamped by people wondering if one can bleed to death making bets on the occurrence of black swans, like Nero, Giovanni Drogo, or the poor scientist with a rich brother-in-law. These people have made their choice for existential reasons, not necessarily economic ones, although the economics of such a strategy makes sense for a collective. 5. Not understanding that doing nothing can be much more preferable to doing something potentially harmful. Mistake made by most people who are not grandmothers. 6. Applying to my ideas labels, skepticism, fat tails, power laws, off a supermarket shelf, and equating those ideas with inadequate research traditions, or worse, claiming it was dealt with by modal logic, fuzzy logic, or whatever the person has vaguely heard of. Mistake made by those with graduate degrees from both coasts. 7. Thinking that the black swan is about the errors of using the bell curve, which supposedly everyone knew about, and that the errors can be remedied by substituting a number from the Mandelbrotian in place of another. Mistake made by the pseudo-scientific brand of tenured finance professors, like, say, Kenneth French. 8. Claiming that we knew all this, and there is nothing new in my idea during 2008, then, of course, going bust during the crisis. Mistake made by the same type of tenured finance professors as before, but these went to work on Wall Street and are now broke. 9. Mistaking my idea for Popper's notion of falsification, or taking any of my ideas and fitting them in a prepackaged category that sounds familiar. Mistakes mostly made by sociologists, Columbia University political science professors, and others trying to be multidisciplinary intellectuals and learning buzzwords from Wikipedia. 10. Treating probabilities of future states as measurable, like the temperature or your sister's weight. People who did a PhD at MIT or something like that, then went to work somewhere, and now spend time reading blogs. 11. Spending energy on the difference between ontic and epistemic randomness, true randomness, and randomness that arises from incomplete information, instead of focusing on the more consequential difference between mediocristan and extremistan. People with no hobby, no personal problems, no love, and too much free time. 12. Thinking I am saying do not forecast or do not use models, rather than do not use sterile forecasts with huge error and do not use models in the fourth quadrant. Mistake made by most people who forecast for a living. 13. Mistaking what I say for crap happens rather than this is where crap happens. Many former bonus earners. Footnote. If most of the people mixed up about the message appear to be involved in economics and social science, while a much smaller share of readers come from those segments, it is because other members of society without such baggage get the book's message almost immediately. Indeed, the intelligent, curious, and open-minded amateur is my friend. A pleasant surprise for me was to discover that the sophisticated amateur who uses books for his own edification, and the journalist, unless, of course, he was employed by the New York Times, could understand my idea much better than professionals. Professional readers, less genuine, either read too quickly or have an agenda. When reading for work or for the purpose of establishing their status, say to write a review, rather than to satisfy a genuine curiosity, readers who have too much baggage, or perhaps not enough, tend to read rapidly and efficiently, scanning jargon terms and rapidly making associations with prepackaged ideas. This resulted early on in the squeezing of the ideas expressed in The Black Swan into a commoditized, well-known framework, as if my positions could be squeezed into standard skepticism, empiricism, essentialism, pragmatism, Popperian falsificationism, Knightian uncertainty, behavioral economics, power laws, chaos theory, etc. But the amateurs saved my ideas. Thank you, listener. As I wrote, missing a train is only painful if you are running after it. I was not looking to have a bestseller. I thought I had already had one with my previous book and just wanted to produce a real thing. So I had to deal with a spate of harrying side effects. I watched as the book was initially treated, owing to its bestseller status, like the non-fiction idea books, journalistic through and through, castrated by a thorough and competent copy editor, and sold in airports to thinking businessmen, giving these enlightened Bildungsphilisters, commonly called idea book readers, a real book is like giving vintage Bordeaux to drinkers of Diet Coke and listening to their comments about it. Their typical complaint is that they want diet book-style actionable steps or better forecasting tools, satisfying the profile of the eventual black swan victim. We will see further that, in an ailment similar to confirmation bias, charlatans provide the much-demanded positive advice, what to do, as people do not value negative advice, what not to do. Now, how not to go bust does not appear to be valid advice, given that over time only a minority of companies do not go bust, avoiding death is the best possible and most robust advice. It is particularly good advice after your competitors get in trouble and you can go on legal pillages of their businesses. Footnote. For instance, one anecdote that helps explain the crisis of 2008. One Matthew Barrett, former chairman of Barclays Bank and Bank of Montreal, both of which underwent blow-ups from exposures to extremistan using risk management methods for mediocristan, complained, after all the events of 2008 and 2009, that the Black Swan did not tell him, what should I do about that, and he can't run a business worrying about Black Swan risks. The person has never heard of the notion of fragility and robustness to extreme deviations, which illustrates my idea that evolution does not work by teaching, but destroying. Also, many readers, say those who work in forecasting or banking, do not often understand that the actionable step for them is to simply quit their profession and do something more ethical. In addition to playing into our mental biases and telling people what they want to hear, these idea books often have an abhorrent, definitive, and investigative tone to their messages, like the reports of management consultants trying to make you believe that they told you more than they actually did. I came up with a simple compression test using a version of what is called Kolmogorov complexity, a measure of how much a message can be reduced without losing its integrity. Try to reduce a book to the shortest length possible without losing any of its intended message or aesthetic effects. My friend, the novelist Rolf Dobelli, he does not seem to like to walk slowly and drags me on hikes in the Alps, an owner of a firm that abstracts books and sells the summaries to busy business people, convinced me that his firm has a lofty mission, as almost all business books can be reduced to a few pages without any loss of their message and essence. Novels and philosophical treatments cannot be compressed. So a philosophical essay is a beginning, not an end. To me, the very same meditation continues from book to book, compared to the work of a nonfiction writer who will, say, move to another distinct and journalistically confined topic. I want my contribution to be a new way of viewing knowledge, the very beginning of a long investigation, the start of something real. Indeed, I am glad at the time of writing, a few years into the life of the book, to see the idea spread among thoughtful readers, inspiring like-minded scholars to go beyond it and seeding research in epistemology, engineering, education, defense, operations research, statistics, political theory, sociology, climate studies, medicine, law, aesthetics, and insurance, though not so much in the area in which the Black Swan found Black Swan-style near-instant vindication, economics. I was lucky that it only took a couple of years and a severe financial crisis for the Republic of Letters to realize that The Black Swan was a philosophical tale. How to expunge one's crimes. My ideas went through two distinctive stages after the release of the book. In the first, as the book hit the bestseller list in almost every single country where it was published, many social scientists and finance practitioners fell into the trap of refuting me with the sole argument that I was selling too many books and that my book was accessible to readers, hence it could not reflect original and systematic thought. It was just a popularization, not worth reading, let alone commenting upon. The first change of regime came with the release of my more difficult mathematical, empirical, and scholarly work in a dozen articles in a variety of journals in an attempt to expiate my crime of having sold too many books. Footnote. So far, about 14 scholarly but very, very boring articles. They are boring both to read and to write. The number keeps growing, though, and they are being published at a pace of 3 a year. Taleb, 2007. Taleb and Pilpel, 2007. Goldstein and Taleb, 2007. Taleb, 2008. Taleb, 2009. Taleb, Goldstein and Spitznagel, 2009. Taleb and Pilpel, 2009. Mandelbrot and Taleb, 2010. Makridakis and Taleb, 2010. Taleb, 2010. Taleb and Tapiero, 2010A. Taleb and Tapiero, 2010B. Taleb and Douadi, 2010, and Goldstein and Taleb, 2010. Then, silence. Still no refutation at the time of this writing. Indeed, my paper on the fourth quadrant in the International Journal of Forecasting, which I simplify in this essay, produced incontrovertible evidence that most, perhaps all, rigorous papers in economics using fancy statistics are just hot air, partaking of a collective scam, with diffusion of responsibility, unusable for any form of risk management. Clearly, so far, in spite of a few smear campaigns, or rather attempts at a smear campaign, typically conducted by former Wall Street persons or Diet Coke drinkers, nobody has managed to present a formal or even informal refutation of the idea, neither of the logical mathematical arguments nor of the empirical arguments. But meanwhile, I figured out something valuable in the packaging of the Black Swan idea. Just as in Fooled by Randomness, I had argued, initially from personal experience, that a 70% chance of survival is vastly different from a 30% chance of death, I found out that telling researchers, this is where your methods work very well, is vastly better than telling them, this is what you guys don't know. So when I presented to what was until then the most hostile crowd in the world, members of the American Statistical Association, a map of the four quadrants, and told them, your knowledge works beautifully in these three quadrants, but beware of the fourth one, as this is where the black swans breed, I received instant approval, support, offers of permanent friendship, refreshments, Diet Coke, invitations to come present at their sessions, even hugs. Indeed, that is how a series of research papers started using my work on where the fourth quadrant is located, etc. They tried to convince me that statisticians were not responsible for these aberrations, which come from people in the social sciences who apply statistical methods without understanding them, something I verified later in formal experiments, to my great horror, as we will see later. The second change of regime came with the crisis of 2008. I kept getting invited to debates, but I stopped obliging, as it became hard for me to hear complicated arguments and restrain a smile, sometimes a smirk. Why a smile? Well, the vindication. Not the intellectual vindication of winning an argument. No. Academia, I discovered, does not change its mind voluntarily, except perhaps in some real sciences such as physics. It was a different feeling. It is hard to focus on a conversation, especially when it is mathematical, when you have just personally earned several hundreds of times the annual salary of the researcher trying to tell you that you are wrong by betting against his representation of the world. A desert crossing. For I had undergone a difficult psychological moment after the publication of The Black Swan. What the French call traversée du désert. When you go through the demoralizing desiccation and disorientation of crossing a desert in search of an unknown destination, or a more or less promised land. I had a rough time shouting fire, fire, fire about the hidden risks in the system, and hearing people ignore the content and instead just criticize the presentation, as if they were saying, your diction in shouting fire is bad. For example, the curator of a conference known as TED, a monstrosity that turns scientists and thinkers into low-level entertainers, like circus performers, complained that my presentation style did not conform to his taste in slickness, and kept my lecture on black swans and fragility off the web. Of course, he subsequently tried to claim credit for my warnings voiced before the crisis of 2008. Footnote. Although his is a bit extreme, this phoniness is not uncommon at all. Many intellectually honest people I had warned, and who had read my book, later blamed me for not telling them about the crisis. They just could not remember it. It is hard for a newly enlightened pig to recall that he has seen a pearl in the past, but did not know what it was. Most of the arguments offered were that times are different, invoking the Great Moderation by one Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve at the time of writing, who fell for the turkey before Thanksgiving trap of not understanding that moving into extremistan comes through a drop in daily volatility. Also, when I was railing against models, social scientists kept repeating that they knew it and that there is a saying, all models are wrong, but some are useful, not understanding that the real problem is that some are harmful, very harmful. As Fat Tony would say, talk is cheap. So Mark Spitznagel and I restarted the business of robustifying clients against the black swan, helping people get closer to the barbell of Chapter 11. We were convinced that the banking system was going to collapse under the weight of hidden risks, that such an event would be a white swan. It was moving from gray to white in color as the system was accumulating risks. The longer we had to wait for it, the more severe it would be. The collapse took place about a year and a half after the publication of the book. We had been expecting it and betting against the banking system for a long time and protecting clients by making them black swan robust, but the reception of the black swan and the absence of refutation that was not ad hominem made us vastly more worried about the need for protection than ever before. Like Antaeus, who lost strength when separated from contact with the Earth, I needed connection to the real world, something real and applied, instead of focusing on winning arguments and trying to convince people of my point. People are almost always only convinced of what they already know. Sticking my neck out in the real world, lining up my life with my ideas by getting involved in trading, had a therapeutic effect, even apart from the vindication. Just having a trade on the books gave me strength to not care. A few months before the onset of the crisis of 2008, I was attacked at a party by a Harvard psychologist who, in spite of his innocence of probability theory, seemed to have a vendetta against me and my book. The most vicious and bitter detractors tend to be those with a competing product on the bookstore shelves. Having a trade on allowed me to laugh at him, or, what is even worse, made me feel some complicity with him, thanks to his anger. I wonder what would have happened to the psychological state of another author, identical to me in all respects except that he had no involvement with trading and risk-taking. When you walk the walk, whether successful or not, you feel more indifferent and robust to people's opinion, freer, more real. Finally, I got something out of my debates. The evidence that black swan events are largely caused by people using measures way over their heads, instilling false confidence based on bogus results. In addition to my befuddlement concerning why people use measures from Mediocristan outside those measures' applicability and believe in them, I had the inkling of a much larger problem, that almost none of the people who worked professionally with probabilistic measures knew what they were talking about, which was confirmed as I got into debates and panels with many hotshots, at least four with Nobels in economics. Really. And this problem was measurable, very easily testable. You could have finance quants, academics, and students use and write papers and papers using the notion of standard deviation, yet not understand intuitively what it meant. So you could trip them up by asking them elementary questions about the non-mathematical, real, conceptual meaning of their numbers. And trip them up we did. Dan Goldstein and I ran experiments on professionals using probabilistic tools and were shocked to see that up to 97% of them failed elementary questions. Footnote: Dan Goldstein and I have been collaborating and running experiments about human intuitions with respect to different classes of randomness. He does not walk slowly. M. Ray Soyar and Robin Hogarth subsequently took the point and tested it in the use of an abhorrent field called econometrics, a field that, if any scientific scrutiny was applied to it, would not exist. Again, most researchers don't understand the tools they are using. Now that the book's reception is off my chest, let us move into more analytical territory. 4. Asperger and the Ontological Black Swan. Are nerds more blind to swans? Social skills in Extremistan. On the immortality of Dr. Greenspan. If the black swan is about epistemic limitations, then, from this definition, we can see that it is not about some objectively defined phenomenon, like rain or a car crash. It is simply something that was not expected by a particular observer. So I was wondering why so many otherwise intelligent people have casually questioned whether certain events, say the Great War or the September 11, 2001 attack on the World Trade Center, were black swans, on the grounds that some predicted them. Of course the September 11 attack was a black swan to those victims who died in it. Otherwise they would not have exposed themselves to the risk. But it was certainly not a black swan to the terrorists who planned and carried out the attack. I have spent considerable time away from the weightlifting room repeating that a black swan for the turkey is not a black swan for the butcher. The same applies to the crisis of 2008, certainly a black swan to almost all economists, journalists, and financiers on this planet, including, predictably, Robert Merton and Myron Scholes, the turkeys of Chapter 17. But certainly not to this author. Incidentally, as an illustration of another common mistake, almost none of those, very few, who seem to have predicted the event predicted its depth. We will see that, because of the atypicality of events in Extremistan, the black swan is not just about the occurrence of some event, but also about its depth and consequences. Asperger probability. This consideration of an objective black swan, one that would be the same to all observers, aside from missing the point completely, seems dangerously related to the problem of underdevelopment of a human faculty called theory of mind, or folk psychology. Some people, otherwise intelligent, have a deficiency of that human ability to impute to others knowledge that is different from their own. These, according to researchers, are the people you commonly see involved in engineering or populating physics departments. We saw one of them, Dr. John, in Chapter 9. You can test a child for underdevelopment of the theory of mind using a variant of the false belief task. Two children are introduced. One child puts a toy under the bed and leaves the room. During his absence, the second child, the subject, removes it and hides it in a box. You ask the subject, where, upon returning to the room, will the other child look for the toy? Those under, say, the age of 4, when the theory of mind starts developing, choose the box, while older children correctly say that the other child will look under the bed. At around that age, children start realizing that another person can be deprived of some of the information they have and can hold beliefs that are different from their own. Now, this test helps detect mild forms of autism. As high as one's intelligence may be, it can be difficult for many to put themselves in other people's shoes and imagine the world on the basis of other people's information. There is actually a name for the condition of a person who can be functional but suffers from a mild form of autism. Asperger syndrome. The psychologist Simon Baron Cohen has produced much research distinguishing between polar extremes in people's temperament with respect to two faculties, ability to systematize and ability to empathize and understand others. According to his research, purely systematizing persons suffer from a lack of theory of mind. They are drawn to engineering and similar occupations, and when they fail to, say, mathematical economics. Empathizing minds are drawn to more social or literary professions. Fat Tony, of course, would fall in the more social category. Males are overrepresented in the systematizing category. Females dominate the other extreme. Note the unsurprising but very consequential fact that people with Asperger syndrome are highly averse to ambiguity. Research shows that academics are overrepresented in the systematizing black swan blind category. These are the people I called Locke's madmen in Chapter 17. I haven't seen any formal direct test of black swan foolishness and the systematizing mind except for a calculation George Martin and I made in 1998, in which we found evidence that all the finance and quantitative economics professors from major universities whom we tracked and who got involved in hedge fund trading ended up making bets against black swans, exposing themselves to blow-ups. This preference was non-random, since between one-third and one-half of the non-professors had that investment style at the time. The best-known such academics were, once again, the Nobel-crowned Myron Scholes and Robert C. Merton, whom God created so that I could illustrate my point about black swan blindness. Footnote: Robert Merton, the villain of Chapter 17, a person said to be of a highly mechanistic mind, down to his interest in machinery and his use of mechanical metaphors to represent uncertainty, seems to have been created for the sole purpose of providing an illustration of dangerous black swan foolishness. After the crisis of 2008, he defended the risk-taking caused by economists, giving the argument that it was a black swan simply because he did not see it coming. Therefore, he said, the theories were fine. He did not make the leap that, since we do not see these events coming, we need to be robust about them. Normally, such people exit the gene pool. Academic tenure holds them a bit longer. They all experienced problems during the crisis, discussed in that chapter, that brought down their firm, long-term capital management. Note that the very same people who make a fuss about discussions of Asperger as a condition not compatible with risk-bearing and the analysis of non-explicit off-model risks with its corresponding dangers to society would be opposed to using a person with highly impaired eyesight as the driver of a school bus. All I am saying is that just as I read Milton, Homer, Taha Hussein, and Borges, who were blind, but would prefer not to have them drive me on the Nice-Marseille motorway, I elect to use tools made by engineers, but prefer to have society's risky decisions managed by someone who is not affected with risk blindness. Future Blindness Redux. Now recall the condition described in Chapter 12 of not properly transferring between past and future, an autism-like condition in which people do not see second-order relations. The subject does not use the relation between the past's past and the past's future to project the connection between today's past and today's future. Well, a gentleman called Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank, went to Congress to explain that the banking crisis, which he and his successor Bernanke helped cause, could not have been foreseen because it had never happened before. Not a single member of Congress was intelligent enough to shout, "Alan Greenspan, you have never died before, not in 80 years, not even once. Does that make you immortal?" The abject Robert Rubin, the bankster I was chasing in Section 2, a former Secretary of the Treasury, used the same argument, but the fellow had written a long book on uncertainty, with, ironically, my publisher and the same staff used for the Black Swan. Footnote. The argument can actually be used to satisfy moral hazard and dishonest, probabilistically disguised, profiteering. Rubin had pocketed more than $100 million from Citigroup's earning of profits from hidden risks that blow up only occasionally. After he blew up, he had an excuse. It never happened before. He kept his money. We, the taxpayers, who include schoolteachers and hairdressers, had to bail the company out and pay for the losses. This I call the moral hazard element of paying bonuses to people who are not robust to black swans, and who we knew beforehand were not robust to the black swan. This beforehand is what makes me angry. I discovered, but by then I was not even surprised, that no researcher had tested whether large deviations in economics can be predicted from past large deviations, whether large deviations have predecessors, that is. This is one of the elementary tests missing in the field, as elementary as checking whether a patient is breathing or whether a light bulb is screwed in. But characteristically, nobody seems to have tried to do it. It does not take a lot of introspection to figure out that big events don't have big parents. The Great War did not have a predecessor. The crash of 1987, in which the market went down close to 23% in a single day, could not have been guessed from its worst predecessor, a one-day loss of around 10%. And this applies to almost all such events, of course. My results were that regular events can predict regular events, but that extreme events, perhaps because they are more acute when people are unprepared, are almost never predicted from narrow reliance on the past. The fact that this notion is not obvious to people is shocking to me. It is particularly shocking that people do what are called stress tests by taking the worst possible past deviation as an anchor event to project the worst possible future deviation, not thinking that they would have failed to account for that past deviation had they used the same method on the day before the occurrence of that past anchor event. Footnote. It is indeed the absence of higher-order representation, the inability to accept statements like, "Is my method for assessing what is right or wrong?" that, we will see in the next section, is central when we deal with probability, that causes Dr. Johns to be suckers for measures and believe in them without doubting their beliefs. They fail to understand the metaprobability, the higher-order probability, that is, the probability that the probability they are using may not be true. These people have PhDs in economics. Some are professors. One of them is the chairman of the Federal Reserve at the time of writing. Do advanced degrees make people blind to these elementary notions? Indeed, the Latin poet Lucretius, who did not attend business school, wrote that we consider the biggest object of any kind that we have seen in our lives as the largest possible item. Et omnia de genere omni, maxima quae vivit quisque, haec ingentia fingit. Probability has to be subjective. Footnote. The non-technical reader should skip the rest of this section. This raises a problem that is worth probing in some depth. The fact that many researchers do not realize immediately that the black swan corresponds mainly to an incomplete map of the world, or that some researchers have to stress this subjective quality. Jochen Runde, for instance, wrote an insightful essay on the black swan idea, but one in which he felt he needed to go out of his way to stress its subjective aspect, takes us to the historical problem in the very definition of probability. Historically, there have been many approaches to the philosophy of probability. The notion that two people can have two different views of the world, then express them as different probabilities, remained foreign to the research. So it took a while for scientific researchers to accept the non-Asperger notion that different people can, while being rational, assign different probabilities to different future states of the world. This is called subjective probability. Subjective probability was formulated by Frank Plumpton Ramsey in 1925 and Bruno De Finetti in 1937. The take on probability by these two intellectual giants is that it could be represented as a quantification of the degree of belief. You set a number between 0 and 1 that corresponds to the strength of your belief in the occurrence of a given event. Subjective to the observer, who expresses it as rationally as he wishes under some constraints. These constraints of consistency in decision-making are obvious. You cannot bet there is a 60% chance of snow tomorrow and a 50% chance that there will be no snow. The agent needs to avoid violating something called the Dutch book constraint. That is, you cannot express your probabilities inconsistently by engaging in a series of bets that lock in a certain loss. For example, by acting as if the probabilities of separable contingencies can add up to more than 100%. There is another difference here between true randomness, say the equivalent of God throwing a die, and randomness that results from what I call epistemic limitations, that is, lack of knowledge. What is called ontological or ontic uncertainty, as opposed to epistemic, is the type of randomness where the future is not implied by the past, or not even implied by anything. It is created every minute by the complexity of our actions, which makes the uncertainty much more fundamental than the epistemic one coming from imperfections in knowledge. It means that there is no such thing as a long run for such systems, called non-ergodic systems, as opposed to the ergodic ones. In an ergodic system, the probabilities of what may happen in the long run are not impacted by events that may take place, say, next year. Someone playing roulette in the casino can become very rich, but if he keeps playing, given that the house has an advantage, he will eventually go bust. Someone rather unskilled will eventually fail. So ergodic systems are invariant on average to paths, taken in the intermediate term, what researchers call absence of path dependency. A non-ergodic system has no real long-term properties. It is prone to path dependency. I believe that the distinction between epistemic and ontic uncertainty is important philosophically, but entirely irrelevant in the real world. Epistemic uncertainty is so hard to disentangle from the more fundamental one. This is the case of a distinction without a difference that, unlike the ones mentioned earlier, can mislead because it distracts from the real problems. Practitioners make a big deal out of it instead of focusing on epistemic constraints. Recall that skepticism is costly and should be available when needed. There is no such thing as a long run in practice. What matters is what happens before the long run. The problem of using the notion of long run, or what mathematicians call the asymptotic property, what happens when you extend something to infinity, is that it usually makes us blind to what happens before the long run, which I will discuss later as pre-asymptotics. Different functions have different pre-asymptotics, according to speed of convergence to that asymptote. But unfortunately, as I keep repeating to students, life takes place in the pre-asymptote, not in some Platonic long run, and some properties that hold in the pre-asymptote, or the short run, can be markedly divergent from those that take place in the long run. So theory, even if it works, meets a short-term reality that has more texture. Few understand that there is generally no such thing as a reachable long run, except as a mathematical construct to solve equations. To assume a long run in a complex system, you need to also assume that nothing new will emerge. In addition, you may have a perfect model of the world, stripped of any uncertainty concerning the analytics of the representation, but have a small imprecision in one of the parameters to input in it. Recall Lorenz's butterfly effect of Chapter 11. Such minutely small uncertainty, at the level of the slightest parameter, might, because of nonlinearities, percolate to a huge uncertainty at the level of the output of the model. Climate models, for instance, suffer from such nonlinearities, and even if we had the right model, which we of course don't, a small change in one of the parameters, called calibration, can entirely reverse the conclusions. We will discuss pre-asymptotics further when we look at the distinctions between different classes of probability distributions. I will say for now that many of these mathematical and philosophical distinctions are entirely overblown, Soviet Harvard style, top-down, as people start with a model and then impose it on reality and start categorizing, rather than start with reality and look at what fits it in a bottom-up way. Probability on a thermometer. This distinction, misused in practice, resembles another deficient separation discussed earlier, between what economists call Knightian risk, computable, and Knightian uncertainty, uncomputable. This assumes that something is computable, when really everything is more or less incomputable, and rare events more so. One has to have a mental problem to think that probabilities of future events are measurable in the same sense that the temperature is measurable by a thermometer. We will see in the following section that small probabilities are less computable, and that this matters when the associated payoffs are consequential. Another deficiency I need to point out concerns a strangely unrealistic and unrigorous research tradition in social science, rational expectations, in which observers are shown to rationally converge on the same inference when supplied with the same data, even if their initial hypotheses were markedly different, by a mechanism of updating called Bayesian inference. Why unrigorous? Because one needs a very quick check to see that people do not converge to the same opinions in reality. This is partly, as we saw in Chapter 6, because of psychological distortions such as the confirmation bias, which cause divergent interpretation of the data. But there is a mathematical reason why people do not converge to the same opinion. If you are using a probability distribution from Extremistan, and I am using a distribution from Mediocristan, or a different one from Extremistan, then we will never converge, simply because if you suppose Extremistan, you do not update or change your mind that quickly. For instance, if you assume Mediocristan and do not witness black swans, you may eventually rule them out. Not if you assume we are in Extremistan. To conclude, assuming that randomness is not epistemic and subjective, or making a big deal about the distinction between ontological randomness and epistemic randomness, implies some scientific autism, that desire to systematize, and a fundamental lack of understanding of randomness itself. It assumes that an observer can reach omniscience and can compute odds with perfect realism and without violating consistency rules. What is left becomes randomness, or something by another name that rises from aleatory forces that cannot be reduced by knowledge and analysis. There is an angle worth exploring. Why on earth do adults accept these Soviet Harvard-style top-down methods without laughing and actually go to build policies in Washington based on them, against the record, except perhaps to make readers of history laugh at them and diagnose new psychiatric conditions? And likewise, why do we default to the assumption that events are experienced by people in the same manner? Why did we ever take notions of objective probability seriously? After this foray into the psychology of the perception of the dynamics of time and events, let us move to our central point, the very core of our program, into what I have aggressively called the most useful problem in philosophy. The most useful, sadly. 5. Perhaps the most useful problem in the history of modern philosophy. Small may not be the idea after all. Where to find the powder room? Predict and perish. On school buses and intelligent textbooks. I am going to be blunt. Before the Black Swan and associated papers, most of epistemology and decision theory was, to an actor in the real world, just sterile mind games and foreplay. Almost all the history of thought is about what we know, or think we know. The Black Swan is the very first attempt, that I know of, in the history of thought to provide a map of where we get hurt by what we don't know, to set systematic limits to the fragility of knowledge, and to provide exact locations where these maps no longer work. To answer the most common criticism by economists and now bankrupt bankers I mentioned in Section 3, I am not saying crap happens. I am saying crap happens in the fourth quadrant, which is as different as mistaking prudence and caution for paranoia. Furthermore, to be more aggressive, while limits like those attributed to Gödel bear massive philosophical consequences, but we can't do much about them, I believe that the limits to empirical and statistical knowledge I have shown have sensible, if not vital, importance, and we can do a lot with them in terms of solutions, by categorizing decisions based on the severity of the potential estimation error of the pair probability times consequence. For instance, we can use it to build a safer society, to robustify what lies in the fourth quadrant. Living in two dimensions. A vexing problem in the history of human thought is finding one's position on the boundary between skepticism and gullibility, or how to believe and how to not believe, and how to make decisions based on these beliefs, since beliefs without decisions are just sterile. So this is not an epistemological problem, i.e. focusing on what is true or false. It is one of decision, action, and commitment. Clearly, you cannot doubt everything and function. You cannot believe everything and survive. Yet the philosophical treatment of the problem has been highly incomplete and, worse, has not improved much over the centuries, if it has improved at all. One class of thinkers, say the Cartesians, or the academic skeptics some 18 centuries before them, in their own way, started with the rejection of everything up front, with some even more radical, such as the Pyrrhonians, rejecting so much that they even reject skepticism as too dogmatic. The other class, say the medieval scholastics or the modern-day pragmatists, starts with the fixation of beliefs, or some beliefs. While the medieval thinkers stop there, in an Aristotelian way, the early pragmatists, with the great thinker Charles Sanders Peirce, provided a ray of hope. They proposed to update and correct beliefs as a continuous work in progress, albeit under a known structure of probability, as Peirce believed in the existence and attainability of an ergodic, long-run, reachable state of convergence to truth. That brand of pragmatism, initially called pragmaticism, viewed knowledge as a rigorous interplay between anti-skepticism and fallibilism, i.e., between the two categories of what to doubt and what to accept. The application to my field, probability, and perhaps the most sophisticated version of the program, lies in the dense, difficult, deep, and brilliant forays of Isaac Levi into decision theory, with the notion of corpus of belief, doxastic commitment, distance from expectation, and creedal probabilities. A ray of hope, perhaps, but still not even close, not even remotely close to anything useful. Think of living in a three-dimensional space while under the illusion of being in two dimensions. It may work well if you are a worm, certainly not if you happen to be a bird. Of course, you will not be aware of the truncation, and will be confronted with many mysteries, mysteries that you cannot possibly clear up without adding a dimension, no matter how sophisticated you may get. And, of course, you will feel helpless at times. Such was the fate of knowledge all these centuries, when it was locked in two dimensions, too simplistic to be of any use outside of classrooms. Since Plato, only philosophers have spent time discussing what truth was, and for a reason. It is unusable in practice. By focusing on the true-false distinction, epistemology remained, with very few exceptions, prisoner of an inconsequential and highly incomplete 2D framework. The third missing dimension is, of course, the consequence of the true and the severity of the false, the expectation. In other words, the payoff from decisions, the impact and magnitude of the result of such a decision. Sometimes one may be wrong, and the mistake may turn out to be inconsequential. Or one may be right, say, on such a subject as the sex of angels, and it may turn out to be of no use beyond intellectual stamp collecting. The simplified, philistinified, academified, and glorified notion of evidence becomes useless. With respect to black swans, you act to protect yourself from negative ones, or expose yourself to positive ones, even though you may have no evidence that they can take place. Just as we check people for weapons before they board a plane, even though we have no evidence that they are terrorists. This focus on off-the-shelf commoditized notions such as evidence is a problem with people who claim to use rigor, yet go bust on occasion. A probabilistic world has trouble with proof as it is, but in a black swan world, things are a lot worse. Indeed, I know of almost no decision that is based on notions of true-false. Once you start examining the payoff, the result of decisions, you will see clearly that the consequences of some errors may be benign, those of others may be severe. And you pretty much know which is which beforehand. You know which errors are consequential and which ones are not so much. But first, let us look at a severe problem in the derivation of knowledge about probabilities. The dependence on theory for rare events. During my deserto period, when I was getting severe but entertaining insults, I found myself debating a gentleman then employed by a firm called Lehman Brothers. That gentleman had made a statement in the Wall Street Journal saying that events we saw in August 2007 should have happened once every 10,000 years. Sure enough, we had three such events, 3 days in a row. The Wall Street Journal ran his picture, and if you look at it, you can safely say, he does not look 10,000 years old. So where is he getting his once-in-10,000-years probability? Certainly not from personal experience, certainly not from the records of Lehman Brothers. His firm had not been around for 10,000 years, and of course it didn't stay around for another 10,000 years, as it went under right after our debate. So you know that he's getting his small probabilities from a theory. The more remote the event, the less we can get empirical data, assuming generously that the future will resemble the past, and the more we need to rely on theory. Consider that the frequency of rare events cannot be estimated from empirical observation for the very reason that they are rare. We thus need a prior model representation for that. The rarer the event, the higher the error in estimation from standard inductive methods, say, frequency sampling from counting past occurrences. Hence, the higher the dependence on an a priori representation that extrapolates into the space of low-probability events, which necessarily are not seen often. Footnote. The a priori I'm using here differs from the philosophical a priori belief, in the sense that it is a theoretical starting point, not a belief that is non-defeasible by experience. But even outside of small probabilities, the a priori problem is always present. It seems salient with respect to rare events, but it pervades probabilistic knowledge. I will present two versions I have been working on with two collaborators. Avital Pilpel, a philosopher of science, he walks fast, and Raphael Douady, a mathematician, he is sometimes a good walker, when he is not busy. Epimenides the Cretan. Avital Pilpel and I expressed the regress argument as follows. As the epistemic problem of risk management, but the argument can be generalized to any form of probabilistic knowledge. It is a problem of self-reference by probability measures. We can state it in the following way. If we need data to obtain a probability distribution to gauge knowledge about the future behavior of the distribution from its past results, and if, at the same time, we need a probability distribution to gauge data sufficiency and whether or not it is predictive of the future, then we face a severe regress loop. This is a problem of self-reference akin to that of Epimenides the Cretan stating whether or not Cretans are liars. Indeed, it is too uncomfortably close to the Epimenides situation, since a probability distribution is used to assess the degree of truth, but cannot reflect on its own degree of truth and validity. And, unlike many problems of self-reference, those related to risk assessment have severe consequences. The problem is more acute with small probabilities. An undecidability theorem. This problem of self-reference, published with Pilpel after the Black Swan, went unnoticed as such, so Raphael Douady and I re-expressed the philosophical problem mathematically, and it appears vastly more devastating in its practical implications than the girdle problem. Raphael is, among the people I know, perhaps the man with the greatest mathematical erudition. He may have more mathematical culture than anyone in modern times, except perhaps for his late father, Adrien Douady. At the time of writing, we may have produced a formal proof using mathematics, and a branch of mathematics called measure theory that was used by the French to put rigor behind the mathematics of probability. The paper is provisionally called Undecidability, on the inconsistency of estimating probabilities from a sample without binding a priori assumptions on the class of acceptable probabilities. It's the consequences. Further, we in real life do not care about simple, raw probability, whether an event happens or does not happen. We worry about consequences, the size of the event, how much total destruction of lives or wealth or other losses will come from it, how much benefit a beneficial event will bring. Given that the less frequent the event, the more severe the consequences, just consider that the 100-year flood is more severe and less frequent than the 10-year flood, the bestseller of the decade ships more copies than the bestseller of the year, our estimation of the contribution of the rare event is going to be massively faulty. Contribution is probability times effect. Multiply that by estimation error. And nothing can remedy it. Footnote. Interestingly, the famous paper by Reverend Bayes that led to what we call Bayesian inference did not give us probability, but expectation, expected average. Statisticians had difficulties with the concept, so extracted probability from payoff. Unfortunately, this reduction led to the reification of the concept of probability, its adherents forgetting that probability is not natural in real life. So the rarer the event, the less we know about its role, and the more we need to compensate for that deficiency with an extrapolative generalizing theory. It will lack in rigor in proportion to claims about the rarity of the event. Hence, theoretical and model error are more consequential in the tails and the good news. Some representations are more fragile than others. I showed that this error is more severe in extremistan, where rare events are more consequential, because of a lack of scale or a lack of asymptotic ceiling for the random variable. In mediocristan, by comparison, the collective effect of regular events dominates and the exceptions are rather inconsequential. We know their effect, and it is very mild because one can diversify thanks to the law of large numbers. Let me provide once again an illustration of extremistan. Less than 0.25% of all the companies listed in the world represent around half the market capitalization. A less than minuscule percentage of novels on the planet accounts for approximately half of fiction sales. Less than 0.1% of drugs generate a little more than half the pharmaceutical industry's sales, and less than 0.1% of risky events will cause at least half the damages and losses.